Fred Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, host David Bell talks with Dean Becker, author of To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and Public, and producer of Cultural Baggage and Century of Lies on KPFT in Houston, Texas. You will recognize his voice from the 420 Drug War News you hear at the end of Jaws of Justice Radio. We will open up the phone lines for your questions and comments later in the show. Stay tuned as today we play our calendar of events at the end of the broadcast, followed by the 420 Drug War News. Now, here is David and his guest, Dean Becker.
Good morning, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1. Today, our guest is Dean Becker, who produces and hosts 9 radio programs per week for the Drug Truth Network, and he's been consulted with a myriad of experts in the field of drug policy. He's also an author of a book, To End the War on Drugs. The topic of today's discussion is the what we'll call a new phase in the war on drugs that our Attorney General, Mr. Sessions, has indicated will be forthcoming. The reason we're exploring it today is we want to talk about the origins of the war on drugs. Where did it start? The impact it's had up until this point, and the repercussions potentially, both positive and negative, of a kind of a restart, if you will, on the war on drugs in light of what I would call a mitigating response by the Obama administration to some of the more drastic provisions of the war on drugs. With that, I would like to introduce our guest today. His name is Dean Becker. And by the way, we will be taking phone calls later on. The phone call phone number is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Mr. Becker, good morning.
Oh, good morning, David. Thank you for this opportunity. It's, I don't know, not exactly old home week, but it's good to be alive here on KKFI.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. I first want to talk very briefly about you, and we're going to move quickly. We do have calls that we want to take today. It's a very big subject matter. Would probably take many shows, but very briefly, if you could talk to me about your experience, your job experience, including your experience in law enforcement, and then some of the work you've done subsequent to that.
Well, sure, David. Yeah, I'm an old guy. I'm 68. I was in U.S. Air Force back in the late 60s, served as a security policeman, mostly guarding B-52s full of bombs back then. But the heck of it is, you know, after that, I went on I became a hippie, to be honest with you. You know, it was the result of not appreciating that war, the Vietnam War. And it put me in contact with a lot of people that I've over the years depended on for their expertise. But I guess what I'd like to really say is that, you know, as a working man in America, it keeps you busy. But in my late 40s, going into my 50s, it dawned on me that this drug war was devouring many of my friends, taking away their lives, their futures, their potential. And I started digging into the how and the why. Where did this all come from? And I discovered that there was really no logical basis for it. It was a propaganda war put forward by moralists and profiteers, charlatans actually, who frightened the American public into believing this drug war to be necessary.
So let's, if we could, Dean, let's start there. Where the term war on drugs, I guess, where does it start, or where did it start? Are you able to pinpoint it?
I think it was embraced, or you know, given a name, so to speak, during the Nixon presidency, but you know, it had been in effect without the full vengeance, I guess, that it developed under Nixon for decades. 1908, the Opium Exclusion Act denied Chinamen the right to smoke it. 1914, the Harrison Narcotics Act went after, you know, heroin and those types of drugs. And, of course, in the 20s and 30s, we got the marijuana prohibitions. But it had been in effect. But it was Nixon that ratcheted up, that started giving more money to police departments around the country to build a narcotics squad to, you know, go after everybody. Of course, we all have heard from Haldeman's quote that Nixon wanted to go after the blacks and the hippies because they were not voting for him. And I guess the whole point of it is it's always been, how to say it, just a pipe dream that somehow we're going to stop people from smuggling drugs, we're going to stop people from using drugs, and someday soon they'll all disappear. And, of course, that's proven to be totally inaccurate.
So let's talk about first of motives, if you will, behind the war on drugs, at least following through from 1910 until today. One motive is, you've mentioned Nixon and Haldeman, is it, talking about you know, wanting to go after individuals that he knew were not supporting his candidacy or his presidency. But surely there are other motives. I can tell you, as a criminal defense attorney, I've seen the kind of repercussions, very negative, of drug use in our community. And so it does bother me, the idea, for example, that heroin would be made legal, or somehow that anybody can go into a drugstore, for example, and buy, you know, pure heroin to experiment with. What would your response be to that?
Well, I would first off say that we should educate our kids to the truth of the matter. You know, no matter how hard we try to eliminate the supply chain, the supply chain finds a way to get back to us. Currently, heroin is made in primitive labs in Afghanistan or Mexico, Central America, by a nearly well-trained chemist. The best percentage we ever get is about 92%. Same holds true for cocaine, methamphetamine, any of these illicit drugs. They approximate the drug they're trying to sell. And then it gets cut with everything from baby powder to rat poison to, I don't know, levamisole, a cancer-causing agent.
Let me stop you there real quick. When you say the word cut, for purposes of our listeners, what does that mean, to cut?
Diluted.
Okay.
Say it comes in at 92%, maybe it lands in Houston or San Antonio, and they take it to one of their safe houses, and they break those kilos down, put it into maybe quarter-pound lots, and mix it with either, you know, they've used quinine in the past. Of late, one of the things they're using on the cocaine is benzocaine, the very stuff that your dentist injects into your gums when he's working on your teeth. They put that now into the cocaine because it gives that numbing effect, what people think they're supposed to expect when they're using cocaine. And heroin, you know, it's made by a very simple process, not near as complicated as doing cocaine. But I guess the point I'm getting at, were it made by Merck or Pfizer, a known 100% product put into a bag with labeling, kids are educated in school, we're educating people daily in the media to the dangers of these drugs, and knowing what's in the bag would make it possible for people to take a usual dose. Under current circumstance, people buy from Joe Blow day after day, gets an approximate quality content from his product. But Joe Blow leaves town, or he gets busted, he goes and buys from somebody else, does the same little pile, puts it in the spoon, shoots it up. But it's not heroin at all. It's fentanyl or carfentanil, 100 times stronger than heroin. Nobody knows what's in the bag. That's how I close my cultural baggage show. Because of prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. And that's what's killing people, is not knowing what's in the bag.
I see. So what you're saying is, what I'm hearing you say is that from a societal standpoint, just by living, there will always be some desire by the population to at some point to use what we're calling drugs to either ease whatever stress they're going through, or perhaps for some individuals, self-medicating further than that if that's going to, if that's a given, then we need to address, all right, so if people are going to put things in their body, let's talk about what they're putting in their body, regulate that to a certain extent, and also educate people so they know the harms of it, whether it's pure or regulated or not. Does that sound correct?
Exactly right, because not knowing day to day what exactly it is you're taking is, I think, just highly dangerous.
Okay, so let's talk then, going back to the war on drugs, is there any, is there some a concept or reasoning, and maybe we've already touched upon it, as to why a term war on drugs was used? We're talking about a war on an inanimate object. It'd be like, you know, war on oranges. I mean, it doesn't make sense when you really think about it. Why are we battling an inanimate object?
David, super question. The fact of the matter is, it's just been a tool, a point of leverage, a topic of discussion, a means to get elected or reelected. It didn't exactly start with Nixon, but it had been ratcheting up coming to his presidency. And ever since, it's been more and more politicians saying, yeah, that's a good point of leverage. It's a means to get votes. And they use it as a tool to get reelected. It's what gave us mandatory minimums and three strikes, you're out, stop and frisk, all of the mechanisms, you know, kick in the door. They might be flushing that stuff. All of this stuff has given means and tactics for not just legislators, but to, police out there on patrol, SWAT teams, et cetera. It is a... it's just run amok.
But I guess
no legitimacy to it.
But I guess my question to you though is let's say that's accurate what you're saying. What's the point of it? Meaning why get into it? Why mm-hmm. promote this? What's who does it benefit? And how
okay.
I guess would be okay. my question.
I hear you, Dave. Yeah, it's well, let's go back to the beginning when they wanted to stop these nasty Chinamen from smoking opium. They came up with the 1908 Opium Exclusion Act. For the 1914 heroin type laws, they wanted to diminish the use of, how to say it, competition drugs to the new pharmaceuticals that were coming into play. And when they wanted to make marijuana illegal, we've all heard the stories of William Randolph Hearst didn't want people competing with his timber to make newspaper, that the Dow Chemical Company didn't want the competition for marijuana to their products. It's always been who's, you know, bull is being gored here, et cetera. And the truth of it is that, well, hell, David, the alcohol prohibition in the 1920s and 30s, people learned, oh, we were doing this wrong. We're empowering terrorists and cartels and gangs in Chicago. And they had the smarts to get out of it. Right now, we're empowering terrorist cartels and gangs to the tune of $380 billion a year and pretending that somehow that's going to stop them from wanting to bring drugs to our shore, to entice our kids to lives of crime and addiction.
So let's talk then about some statistics. Again, we're talking about the war on drugs. We're not yet to the point of Obama, because we want to go into how Obama's administration, President Obama, mitigated some of the impact of the war on drugs. But before that, let's talk about statistics. Do you have any statistics that I can kind of help our listeners and myself conceptualize how much this has cost? You've mentioned the $380 billion. Is there, what other costs have you identified, whether you have figures or not, that the war on drugs have cost to society?
Well, and if I could, I want to underscore that $380 billion a year. That's the number that was given to me by Anthony Placido, who was then the assistant director of the ONDCP. That's been a couple of years back. It may have gone up or down, but it's an approximation for sure. Each year we spend 50, some say $100 billion here in the United States, to stop the flow of drugs, to wage this war on drugs. And, over the decades, that's easily now totaled up to well over $1 trillion that we've, quote, invested into this effort. We pretend this is a true democracy, but, you know, a stat I like to share with people is that the United States arrests more black people per capita for drugs than did South Africa for apartheid, under apartheid. And I guess it is a means to maintain a little bit of racial dominance, I guess, if you will, to I don't want to go in that direction much further, because I can't speak, being a white man, I can only speak to the stats that I have encountered. But the friends I have talked to tell me that it works that way on a daily basis, that being in certain neighborhoods is just gives police the license to treat you as a suspect just for, you know, walking out your door.
So essentially we're talking about a means of social control, and I wonder, going back to your mention of the opium laws in 1910, if that was an intent there. And even if it wasn't an intent, and this is something I deal with in the law a lot, it's hard sometimes to look into the heart of a legislature or a judge or a prosecutor or whomever and figure out what it is they're meaning or intending. But it's a little bit easier, actually a lot easier, to look at who the law, who the act is impacting. And if you can look at that only, it's very clear, it would seem to me, based on the statistics that you've talked about and that I've personally seen and read about, that the war on drugs disparately impacts people of color.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there is no doubt, sir. There are certain states where, you know, it's 99% arrests of blacks for possession or sale, what have you.
So
just last week, I was talking with Neil Franklin, the director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, the new name, and they were talking about similar situations. You know, that it's just certain neighborhoods get the patrols, certain neighborhoods get the stop and frisk, certain neighborhoods get the focus, and that's been just part of it. It is what makes this drug war function. It is what gives license, so to speak, for these efforts, and has destroyed many neighborhoods, sending the breadwinners to prison and making it where they can't live with their family once they come back. So many ways that they separate and destroy those family connections and, in essence, that community. And it's not slowing down much.
So, and again, this is a call-in show, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. I now want to talk to you briefly as we kind of move through this, and we've gone a little bit quickly only because we want to get to the heart of it, which is Attorney General Sessions. But let's talk about what Obama did to mitigate some of the impact of the war on drugs. Is that something you can briefly tell us about, and then I can add to it based on my work as a federal defense attorney?
Excuse me. Yes, sir. I'd like to add a couple of points. I'd like to think of Obama played rope-a-dope. You know, he didn't exactly go on the attack. He didn't finish the fight, that's for sure. But he allowed activists and reformers and I like to think forward-thinking politicians to get some stuff done. They managed to, you know, ease up on the marijuana arrests, allow for legal marijuana to be voted on in certain states and to be implemented and to have a positive effect in those states, both financially and, you know, I think personally, however you want to look at it. But he was given the opportunity, I think, to have ended the war on marijuana or to at least opened the door to that possibility. The Toom Gang, the coke using, pot smoking, now former president. The hypocrisy of it all is what motivates me, is what keeps me going. Despite his youthful indiscretions, he went on to become president of the United States. And the same holds true for Bush II and so forth. We know they were known drug users, and yet life didn't. Their lives were not destroyed. Their possibilities were not ended. despite all of the warnings from the ONDCP and the DEA. And I guess my thought there is that the time is up. I searched the world looking for that interview with some high elected official, someone who can do one thing for me, and that is give me the number one benefit of the drug war. And certainly there isn't one. There's a hope, a dream, but there is no benefit.
Sure. Well, let me do this. Let me talk briefly for our listeners about the federal criminal system and how it works with drugs. Generally speaking, there's two systems that play in the federal system. One is the statute. Certain statutes say, hey, it's illegal to essentially possess or possess with intent to sell or sell certain narcotics based upon weight. Those provisions then also have minimums attached to them. The second part that we deal with in the federal system are called the sentencing guidelines. Usually the statutory provisions provide for a minimum and then a maximum, and then the sentencing guidelines permit you to fine-tune that to where you can find a range, if you will, within those statutory minimums and maximums. As I understand from looking into what Obama did, that essentially we've got a statutory minimum. For simple mandatory minimum cases, you can have a minimum sentence of 5 years in certain cases. But if you have a prior drug felony, whether state or federal, that automatically doubles to 10. If you have a second one, that could go all the way to life in prison. You have other drugs that have a statutory minimum of 10 years, that then with one prior felony will get you to 20 years. Two prior felonies get you to life. And that's essentially what I understand Obama did, was he came in and told his federal prosecutors, listen, you have the discretion to file a motion essentially under Section 851 telling the court and the defendant that we are going to seek an increase in these mandatory minimums. So from 5 to 10 or 5 to life, or from 10 to 20 or 10 to life. You have the discretion to seek that or not seek that. And I think what Obama said was, hey, unless it's the most serious of cases where we have individuals where we believe are ringleaders, we don't want you seeking the increase in those mandatory minimums. I think that was the general idea of what Obama did. He also, as you indicated, went back and said, with regard to marijuana, we're going to allow the states essentially to police or handle how they wish to deal with that. Is that a basic understanding from your standpoint, Dean?
I would agree with that, David. Yeah, and I like to think of it as, again, he allowed the states to vote and set up their framework for marijuana distribution and growth however they wanted to. And it's my understanding that now Jeff Sessions wants to undo all of that. He wants to roll back the Obama perspective.
Correct. And just to be clear, for those individuals that are listening that are unfamiliar with the federal system, we've got the mandatory minimums, or any prison sentence in the federal system, is that the sentence itself, and there is no parole. So for individuals that think that they'll go down on a five-year sentence and when they hit prison, the federal prison, they will just turn around in the kind of the U-shaped parking area of the prison and come right back again and be released, that's not the case. There is a provision that allows you to get out after 85% if you have good time. There's also other provisions that may slightly decrease the sentence, but generally speaking, if you get 60 months, you're doing 60 months or a little bit less as a result of that. So when we talk about these mandatory minimums and upping them, we have individuals that are going to spend life in prison, and there is no parole when you have life in prison. That's life in prison without parole. You come out on a stretcher. There is no other way out. We're really talking about serious consequences, and I think what you're talking about is Jeff Sessions introduced a letter to the prosecutors where he said in there, I encourage you to employ the full complement of federal law to address the problem of violent crime in your district. Further guidance and support in executing this priority, including an updated memo on charging for all criminal cases, will be forthcoming. There was also another indication from Mr. Sessions that, as you indicated, we will be removing taking the gloves off, if you will, in the ability of the prosecutors to seek more aggressively these mandatory minimums. And I guess from your perspective, Mr. Becker, what are the problems with that approach to criminal behavior in general, drugs and violent crime?
Well, you know, again, if we reach back to 1908 or we go to 1914 Harrison Act or the 37 Marijuana Tax Act or the Controlled Substance Act or the Boggs Act or any of these, I'm sorry for laughing, but it has taken on a quasi-religious frenzy that they're doing all this, and in essence, for God and country, that somehow it's the patriotic thing to do. And they just keep trying. And in the meantime, as I said before, we're empowering our terrorist enemies. We're enriching barbarous cartels. We're creating reasons for these gangs to exist. We maintain this black market through through the threat of gunfire and mayhem. It is a fruitless, pointless, feckless piece of work. This drug war, it has never achieved any of its stated goals. It's never stopped one person from getting their hands on drugs. It just ensures more death, more disease, more crime, more addiction, more madness. And I don't know that if I answered your question, but I don't think I have an answer to that question, sir.
Well, sure. Well, it sounds to me like, from what you're saying, that we are, again, about to focus on the wrong aspects, if you will, or at least the maybe a symptom of a problem rather than an underlying problem. So, for example, sure. as to why people seek to self-medicate with more serious drugs, are we maybe better off using that $1 trillion investment not in police forces or arming law enforcement with tank-like vehicles and machine guns, but rather using that money in a way that helps people maybe make better choices when they deal with mental health issues or various life stressors?
Well said. I couldn't much improve on that, David, other than to just say, you know, drugs are made by untrained chemists, cut with all kinds of BS, sold to our kids at 100 times their true retail price. It creates this sense of rebelliousness. It creates this sense of, we're radical kids, and you know we're special, aren't we? And the thing I guess I'm trying to say there is that you make it legal, you sell it at the Kroger store or the drug store for that penny on the black market dollar. You make it something that adults use. You take away that rebellious nature. Nobody's dying or getting making money off the black market anymore. That enticement to get involved is taken away. It doesn't lure our children any longer. Before you know it, the overdose deaths are going to be about, well, hell, just those people committing suicide because people will know what they're taking.
Sure.
And we'll lose this frenzy, and law enforcement will lose this point of leverage for kicking in doors and you know, the tanks, as you say, and the battering rams and all of these justifications that are slowly robbing us of our civil rights. The drug war has done great damage to our civil rights.
And I agree with that. And I think at this, I want to save that for the second half of our show. Again, it's a call-in show, 816-931-5534. All right, good morning. You're back listening to Jaws of Justice, 90.1 KKFI. My name is David Bell. On the phone with us today is Dean Becker. Mr. Becker, I want to briefly talk to you about some of these encroachments upon our civil rights that you had mentioned previously. What could you give us an idea of that? What are some of the, I guess, the top, few that we deal with as the war on drugs kind of take its toll on communities?
Well, I can just say this, that it has just escalated. I don't know which is first, whether it's life emulating art or art emulating life, but you see it in the movies over the decades. You know, we used to handcuff people in the front, put their hands in front and handcuff them, put them in the car. It was with about the time of Nixon's declaration of drug war that we started getting tough on these drug users and in effect, everybody, because if you got to apply it to drug users, you got to apply it to everyone else. We started cuffing people in the back and, trying to use, quote, tough love, treat them bad, show them they're messing up, they got to straighten their ways. and just giving people more abuse, more vengeance, if you will, from law enforcement and certainly the courts as time went along. It was, we're going to teach all these hippies and folks a lesson. We're going to break them of their habit. We're going to show them what the good folks do. And, of course, it's never done what they were wanting to do. And I guess what I'm saying is that, and we talked about it earlier, we got the mandatory minimums. We got SWAT teams with tanks and battering rams now. We've got the stop and frisk attitude. Every car needs search. Look in that glove box under the seat. Check under the floor mats. Looking for that tiny amount of drugs that would justify an arrest, that would help increase you know, funding from the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. It has been an attempt to control the intake of our fellow man. We've got to deny them the right to snort that powder or smoke that weed or whatever, because it's, in essence, God's will. But, and that's been, in essence, part of what they've been up to as well. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. And again, this is a call-in show, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. I guess my question to you now then is perhaps we go to Jeff Sessions, I've never met, never talked to, probably never will, but we say to him, listen, you know, what are you saying the benefit here is here? And perhaps he says, and I'm just speculating here, he says, listen, we have a bunch of people that are out engaging in unlawful activity, drug activity, which wouldn't necessarily bother me except that it's denying our society the productivity that those individuals would otherwise have had they not been using drugs in such a prolific nature. And so let's just say that's the answer. And I don't know that, but I can tell you that some of the individuals I've worked with, I've known, whatever it may be, represented, that when they're high, they are not in their most productive state. It just seems, and I know there's arguments to the contrary with medical marijuana. I'm not talking about that. For the most part, people that appear to be high, or at least appear to be under the influence, are not individuals I would necessarily trust as much as those individuals that weren't. And that may be naive on my part, but
let me
go ahead.
If I can.
Yeah.
I'm with you 1%, maybe 99%. I'm not sure. Let me just phrase it this way. There are people who have problems with drugs. I agree 100% with you there, David. But then again, we have people who get by every day using a different drug that's totally legal that was once prohibited, and that is alcohol. I like to compare the use of alcohol to the use of heroin. The results are very similar in that what happens to that person in the long run. And I guess what I'm trying to say here, sir, is that if heroin users knew what they were taking on a daily basis, perhaps their lives would be more productive. Perhaps if they didn't have to go scrounge up money to buy that 100, that drug at 100 times what it should cost. Maybe if they didn't have to search the city streets looking for it, they could be more productive.
Go ahead. No, we've got one caller on the phone. I wanted to make sure we got to it because we only have one line open. Caller, go ahead. State your name and what where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Daniel. I'm from Grandview. And my question has to do with the scheduling. Marijuana is scheduled as a number one item. And my question, I think, that I'm asking ought to be asked over and over again until it is finally resolved. And what will it take to change that scheduling on a federal level? I think this has to be done, and this has to be asked until it is done.
Thank you very much. We're gonna cut you off at this point, caller, and get your answer off the air so we can open up the phone lines. Mr. Becker, could you briefly address the caller's question, and with a little bit of an explanation as to what scheduled drugs means.
Sure. Schedule 1 says that marijuana is among the most dangerous, up there with heroin and LSD, which I could argue a point the points on those two drugs as well. But the point of it is it makes it the most illegal, the most, quote, dangerous and deadly. And it makes where the penalties are well beyond what they ought to be. In the 1970s, Schaefer Report came out, analyzing America's war on marijuana and determined that it's way overboard. About the same time, federal judge Francis Young came out and said the war on marijuana is arbitrary and capricious. It needs to end. Nixon threw all of this in the trash can. They just didn't want to deal with it. And since that point in time, it's just slowly diminished in its draconian ways, I guess.
I see.
We've got 8 states now made it legal, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess the point I'd like to get to is that marijuana doesn't belong in the Controlled Substance Act at all. We have created the situation where they're, like all drug laws, you take a situation and you make it where people try to make a stronger and stronger and stronger version of that, so it's easier to smuggle, easier to, transport. And what we've done with marijuana has made it to where they now have these space balls and moon rocks and all of these things that, hell, if you take them at home, that'd be just fine. I don't know what to say. Marijuana is not the threat it was ever purported to be.
So, and with that, we'll take our next caller. Caller, you're on the line. Please state your name, where you're calling from, and what your question is.
Yeah, my name is Mike. I'm calling from Midtown. I'd like to share a couple of uneducated or personal observations on drugs. And the first one is, I don't believe personally that legalizing it or making it illegal really changes the amount of usage. But I think it is a little bit dishonest to say that the laws are being based are racially motivated. I mean, African American community, Hispanic American community, whites, they use it at the rate they use it, and that's how they're punished because of it. It's drugs aren't necessarily. I mean, I think we can all agree that people that use drugs are generally less productive in society. They cause more problems. If you've ever seen addicted babies in hospitals and things like that, there's a lot of costs out there because of it. Now, if you want to legalize it, that's fine. But to say that the African American community is somehow being punished because they happen to use drugs more than other racial groups, I think is a little bit dishonest.
And Mr. Becker, what is your caller?
Well, let me see if I understood you there, Mike. You're talking about the implementation of the drug war on the black and Hispanic communities is out of balance, and that I would agree with. But people, black, white, yellow, brown, use drugs at approximately the same rate. It is where the focus of the police and the courts is where it's focused. It is the problem. And it's easier to get a warrant or to, make these arrests in poor neighborhoods. And that's where the real imbalance occurs. The rich, they never have their compounds searched. Whereas with people who are poor, it's much easier to do it. They can't afford the lawyers. It's much easier to get a conviction.
But I guess...
Well, go ahead. Okay, I would agree with you. You're going to be more likely to be punished if you're poor because you can't afford the lawyers. I agree with that. But I'm not sure where you get your statistic on they use it the same rate, because I don't think that's true. Percentage-wise, I think in the African-American community, they use more drugs than say, Hispanics. Hispanics generally use it more than whites. I think there's other driving factors. I think if you look at the single-parent homes, African-American kids are, I think it's somewhere in the high 70s, 80% of them grow up without a father in the family. Hispanics, it's somewhere around 50%, and whites, it's growing. And as it grows, those numbers do become more balanced. I think personally that's probably more of a driving factor.
I think, this is David, I think my experience has been, and I don't have a statistic to cite, but it's statistics I've read, I'll just have to take my word on it, that drug use is the same amongst all different races. It doesn't, that is a fallacy. And that is sometimes used to justify the war on crime. The one movie I'd ask you to take a look at, caller, that I found to be somewhat shocking, although as a public defender and now as a private criminal defense attorney, I saw with my eyes, but they put it all together, is the movie 13th. It's a wonderful movie. I believe it's on Netflix, if I saw it, and it talks about the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which basically banned slavery, but then said slavery is essentially okay in the case of individuals committed of a crime. And so it talks about how slavery, to a certain extent, has then been pushed through and made legal through other means. And so, you know, to say that a congressman or woman decided that we're going to harm black lives by passing these drug laws, I can't say that. Like I said at the beginning, you can't look into the heart of these individuals that are doing it, but you can sure tell by the impact on the communities. And if you were just to land right now from Mars and look around and say, my goodness, who, you know, what are these drug laws intending to do? Without knowing anything about the drafters of it, you would look and see the impact on certain communities and say, well, it's obvious. Our prison system, our drug laws, et cetera, are here to negatively impact persons with black and brown skin. Go ahead.
I stand 100% with you there, David. And the gentleman, Mike, was talking about, you know, the fathers aren't there. Well, why the hell aren't they there? They're in prison, many of them. They're on parole and probation. They cannot live because of state obligations with their family anymore. We have created this situation. We have compounded it, certainly.
So let's caller, thank you so much for calling. Again, we have a number of callers that want to call in, but we only have one line open because we do have Mr. Becker here, 816-931-5534. Mr. Becker, are you familiar, by the way, with the statistics that individuals of all races use drugs, what I'm calling drugs, at the same rate?
Yes, you kind of caught me short here. I agree with you. I've heard it anecdotally many times from the experts that I've had on my show. I don't have a direct quote or a reference I can give you, but I can certainly underscore what you said.
Sure, and I guess it's interesting. Let's say that that is true. And again, I'm not, just because I say it doesn't mean it's true. And I hope other individuals, to the extent that they disagree with me, would find information either to the contrary or in support. But let's say it is true. It's interesting that the caller and perhaps other in the communities may automatically assume that drug use must be higher amongst individuals with black and brown skin. And I wonder, just out loud, if perhaps that comes in part from images we see on TV, in the media, and things like that.
I think you're right. I mean, I have no doubt that's at least part of why people have that perspective.
And so then we get to the part, then we get to a point where it almost becomes this war on drugs, almost becomes a kind of this endless cycle upward. So then now we've got, let's say that is true. Let's say that we then look at who the war on drugs negatively impacts a certain community. Let's say the African-American community. Now all we see are African-American men primarily in chains and jail. And now we say, well, that community has to have a problem. It needs a solution. We need to get tougher with the war on crime. Is that how it kind of spirals out of control?
You nailed it again, Dave. I look at it this way. I mean, it is a means to propagandize and continue the war by showing all these people in chains, as you say, and to just frighten the American populace into believing this to be necessary. And I don't know if you've ever heard me use this phrase, but the drug war is a quasi-religion. It is a means to perpetuate this draconian system to make people believe it. Either you're with us or against us, you know, quoting old Bush the Second. And it just has no nexus with reality. It is a means to subjugate and demonize and control a certain, you know, portions of our population.
Again, this is a call-in show. We're at 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. We do have a line open now that this caller's hung up. Go ahead, Mr. Becker.
Yeah, I was just going to say, KKFI, I want to thank you guys for using the 420 Drug War News over the years. You're one of the many stations who have done so. I don't get paid. I don't get one dime for Pacifica or anybody. This is my gift to society. I think my book is a gift to society. 115 experts who give their perspectives on the drug war. It is my hope that once I'm gone, maybe once we end prohibition, we build a big monument warning people to never do this again, because it has, we've arrested nearly 50 million of our fellow citizens, spent well over $1 trillion of our taxpayer dollars. We're empowering terrorist cartels and gangs worldwide on a continual basis. And we've never even managed to stop one child from getting their hands on drugs. It is it's just a stupid effort. There's no other word for it. It's evil.
And I guess talking about drugs, we talk about war on drugs. Oh, hold on for one sec, Mr. Becker. We do have a caller. Caller, you're on the line at KKFI, Jaws of Justice. State your name, where you're calling from, and your comment.
Yeah, my name is Melvin, and I'm calling from Midtown. And my, one of my comment is that I think that a lot of people think that blacks represent using drugs more so than any other culture, and that's not true. And I think that we are overrepresented in terms of the negatives. And so it's the same thing as well as a lot of people thought that more blacks are on welfare than whites, and that's not true. And I think that that needs to be brought out in this same platform or this topic.
Caller, this is David. Let me ask you this. Why do you think that image is being portrayed, meaning what's in it and for whom?
Well, I think our society, because it's so set up in terms of races, and that might be a harsh word, but I think your guest kind of alluded to it at one time. But I think that it's another form of putting down a certain culture, making it less than, and by focusing more on the negative. They're robbers, they're dope dealers, and stuff like that. Kind of the same thing that Trump did with Hispanics and saying that they're bad dudes, you know, those kinds of things. And as a society, we know that's not true. We have good people and bad people on both sides of the fence. And so
Melvin,
it depends on how much they're focusing on.
Hold on. We're talking. Hold on.
There are some good things going on.
Hold on. We're talking over each other. Caller, we only have a few minutes left. I do appreciate your call. I'm going to let Mr. Becker respond, and then we will end this. Thank you again for listening. Mr. Becker, go ahead and respond to the caller, and then we'll make a few points, and then we'll have to end our show.
I'm sorry for stepping on you there, Melvin. I appreciate what you were bringing forward. Yes, sir, this is true. I mean, and you talked about it, David. You see it on TV, all the blacks lined up in the courtroom or walking down the hallway or whatever. And what this is a means to justify and continue this war on drugs, to give us that black man, he's doing drugs. You know, I'm trying to not cuss here. It is just stupid and evil. It has never accomplished any of its stated goals. It's just a means to frighten and, perpetuate this war.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just aggravated, Melvin. Thank you for bringing that up.
I think we're not trying to. And just to be clear to Melvin, our listeners, we've addressed a number of times Jaws of Justice radio show, whether through myself or others, the how race and the criminal justice system are intertwined, and so we're not trying to shy away from it. On the other hand, we only had a limited period of time, and we wanted to focus very briefly on Jeff Sessions. Hold on for one sec. I think we may have one more caller. Is that right?
Okay.
Yeah, we have one more caller, and then we'll have to, at that point, end. Caller, state your name and where you're calling from and what your comment is.
Mary Pat Mayer, Kansas City, Missouri.
All right, what's your comment?
In the Waldo Brookside area.
Great. What's your comment today?
I was just going to comment on, I'm glad that you brought up the 13th, the movie. I think everybody needs to see that. I think there's money to be made in made-for-profit prisons, and I think that's a huge issue in this country.
Yes, and that's one.
I think that's part of the problem.
Right, and so the question that and caller, thank you very much for your call. I think one of the issues that the caller brings up, and we'll have to end with this point, and then Dean, I'll give you the last word. One of the issues is with the war on drugs. Is anybody making money off of it? We know that drug dealers, I guess, presumably, although I think there's some question there, make money off the sale of drugs. But with regard to the war on drugs, who's getting wealthy on that? And it looks to me, based on just anecdotally what I've seen, is you've got the prison system, you have the people that are supplying the prison system, you have people that make guns to arm the police and all the accoutrements that go with it. You have the courts, you have the prosecutors, you have me as defense attorney. I also benefit from it. So you have a significant industry that's built around the perpetuation of the war on drugs. But that being said, I guess we've got 30 seconds left, and then I'll close at that point. And I want to give those 30 seconds to you, Mr. Becker. And just, again, you're the author of To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and Public by Dean Becker. But I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds. What would you want our listeners to be left with at this point?
But, okay, I'm just going to underscore what you were saying there, David, and that is a couple of other large outfits that profit from the war on drugs. That's the pharmaceutical house. They don't want marijuana or even heroin to be legal because it's much cheaper and safer than Oxy. You've got the urine testers that don't want to lose that cash cow. Same with the treatment providers that love to treat marijuana addicts and on down the line. And I guess the whole point of it is there is no reason for this to continue. Let's tax, regulate, and control 1 cent on the black market dollar. Much of the death, disease, crime, and addiction will disappear immediately.
Mr. Becker, I want to thank you for being on our show. And to all of our listeners and our callers out there, I want to thank you. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Now, the calendar for April 17th. You are invited to attend the next NAACP KCMO Branch General Membership Meeting on Tuesday, April 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, Cleveland and Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. General business will take place from 6:30 to 7 p.m., followed by a presentation on the establishment of a conviction integrity unit in Kansas City. This month's Corey's Network will have two opportunities for you to help out families affected by homicide. The family of Jessica Runyon, whose body was recently located near Belton, is setting up a trust for her younger siblings. You can also help raise money for funeral expenses for the family of 2-year-old homicide victim, Michaela Rolfe. Chuck E. Cheese will donate 15% of food and token sales on Wednesday, April 19th from 3 to 9 p.m. at their Tiffany Springs location, 9196 North Skyview Avenue, KCMO. And again, on Friday, April 21st, 3 to 9 p.m. at their Independence location, 18701 East 39th Street, Independence, Missouri. The Youth Ambassadors Summer Job Program is now taking applications. Youth Ambassadors is an educational, not-for-profit employment program designed to empower underserved youth with the knowledge that they, as teenagers, have a vital voice. For more information about the application process, contact Paige at 913-953-1683. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Tune in next week when Craig Lubal talks with the Midwest Innocence Project and Teresa Wilkie talks with the Missouri Commission for Human Rights. Up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is part of a discussion I had with U.S. Congressman from El Paso, Beto O'Rourke, who's running for Ted Cruz's Senate seat.
You know what? There's been a ton of energy throughout the state so far. We're only 48 hours into this, but in El Paso, in Dallas, in Waco, in Austin, now here in Houston, folks are turning out. They're not waiting for anybody else, and they're taking it upon themselves, and they're going to get behind the guy who showed up to make a difference and take back the state and take back this country. And it's on all of the issues. It's on reproductive rights. It's on jobs. It's on education. It's on our national defense. It's on taking care of veterans. And Dean, I tell everyone about you. The issue that you've really led on far longer than I've even been aware of it is the need to ensure that this government treats everyone with respect, that we're not prosecuting a war on drugs that will never win, that's wasted $1 trillion and so many lives, imprisons more people in this country than any other country on the face of the planet, where more than half of the states in this country through popular decisions have already ended their war on people through marijuana, through legislatures, through statewide referendums to medicinalize, decriminalize, or outright end the prohibition. We can wait for Texas to do it, or we can elect a senator from Texas who will do it. And I think that's exactly what we're about to do right now. And that will allow us to keep marijuana out of schools, where that's one of the most rapidly expanding markets today, away from kids whose minds are still developing, the profits away from criminals and cartels, and allow us to focus on real, national, important public health problems like the opioid crisis and epidemic and abuse and death. Hundreds of thousands of Americans who've lost their lives in this, who need our help right now. They don't need us fighting a failed war on drugs. So my gratitude to you. You've been an inspiration to me. You were there for me when I first got involved in this issue. And I'm grateful, and I'm so glad to be in Houston with you right now, man. It makes my day.
Thank you, Beto. I had one last thought. But we did make a change here. Starting the 1st of March, we stopped arresting kids, doing stupid things, being out on the streets with marijuana.
That's right. Yeah, I'm so proud of and impressed by Houston. Again, not waiting for outside money to figure it out, not waiting for the statewide leadership to tell them what to do. That's the model for the rest of the state. Believe me, we're going to follow your lead.
All right, Beto, one more time, if you would, share your website. Folks need to get involved.
BetoForTexas.com. If you sign up, if you make a donation, whatever size, if you then share that with your friends and family and coworkers and even strangers on social media, that will ensure that the only campaign for Senate not funded by corporate cash, no political action committee money, only through Texans and real working people, that campaign, which so many people have thought is impossible, if you go to BetoForTexas.com.
Ted Cruz has been invited to respond. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.